much. It's a pleasure to be here. This first slide has a disclaimer that says you shouldn't believe anything I say, and I'm ripe with conflicts of interest. There'll be four more pages at the back that say basically the same thing. What I'd really like to discuss today is probably the most exciting 5 years that an analyst has had in the electric utility industry, and I think those are just upcoming. Mainly because of these three issues, which will provide huge fractures in returns available to utility shareholders, and also an awful lot of opportunity for capital raising and, frankly, some capital destruction as well. We're going into the first capital cycle that the regulated space has had since the 1970s, and it brings with it a great deal of opportunities and risks, and I'd like to discuss how the cycle works. I'd then like to discuss what history has told us about the cost of capital implications of a cycle like we're going to experience. And then I'd like to talk about really the elephant in the room, which is what do we do about carbon? I think there are a huge range of cost implications and financial implications from that debate, which we're having right now and will continue to have for the next several years. Capital cycle. The regulated utility industry has basically gone merrily along for about 20 years without spending anything materially in excess of their depreciation and amortization. So in other words, we've been essentially maintaining rate base with a progress of 1 or 2% a year. That's about to change significantly because of three pressures. The first pressure is from policy requirements on the environment. The four pollutants that we currently regulate are forcing upgrades to our coal fleet. These are SOx, NOx, fine particulates, and mercury. We're also seeing a significant push in CapEx as a result of lagging infrastructure on transmission. It was really highlighted in the blackouts that we had in 2002, but as a result of underspending for a couple of decades. And then finally, we look forward to a period very soon where we're going to need a great deal of generation resources again, but for other policy reasons, we've shut off a lot of the traditional sources that we might have utilized. We will have another California energy crisis. It's just going to be in New Jersey this time. What I think will happen as a result of this CapEx budget that I outlined on the previous slide, is we're going to see, for the first time in a couple of decades, a lot of stress put on the relationship between utility shareholders, and interest holders, and their customers. And that's because the implications of a capital cycle, coupled with the impact of fuel increases that we also are experiencing, is that prices are going to go up, and not a little, quite a lot. This slide gives you a forecast of what we expect the U.S. electric utility industry price trajectory to look like. And we break it down between the impacts of fuel, which are dominating the near term, just the higher prices of natural gas, coal, oil, etc., but are quickly overtaken by the impacts of increasing rate base and revenue relief that are required from that new infrastructure. We expect about 10 to 12% a year increases required from this industry through the end of the decade, and quite possibly through 2015. I just don't have a forecast that far. Cumulatively, we're looking for about a 66% nominal increase in prices between now and 2010. That's not going to feel good when you look at this chart. Now, we have done this before. We did it in the 70s. In 1973 to 84, we experienced exactly this. This chart is the percentage of consumer spending on electric bills. And during the 1970s, for some of the same reasons, that is, a fuel shock that was followed by a policy change that required infrastructure build, that time nuclear, we saw a ramp in the percentage of consumer wallet that went to electricity from about 1.4% to a little over 2%. from that time until 2005, we experienced deflation. And so it was a pretty easy time, I think, from an interface between regulators and utilities for the last 20 years, the deregulation experiment. Over the next 5 years, it looks like we're going to probably repeat the trajectory that we saw in the 70s, and that's going to bring back a lot of old issues, and we'll see how we deal with them this time. So let me point out what some of those issues are. The first issue is, if you're a regulator in the room, you're going to be really busy. Two-thirds of my companies have a major rate case in the next 12 months, and all of them have a major rate case in the next 24. What this chart shows, the left-hand scale in the bar chart, is the number of rate cases per quarter since 1980. And when we were putting in nuclear power plants, we had a very high number of rate cases underway, and that's what you see in the bubble on the left-hand side of the page. We then went through a very, very quiet period. There was also a period that was quiet in a declining interest rate environment, which is what's measured on the right-hand scale. And so now what we're facing is a sharp jump in rate activity, but with a vastly different backdrop of interest rates. That's the backdrop for the next discussion, which is, what does that mean for cost of capital? Well, first, it refocuses us on this chart. What this chart is the comparison between the risk-free rate, so we use the 10 years as a proxy, utility equity duration is somewhere in the 8 plus year range, and the allowed returns authorized by public commissions. What you'll find is that while we've had an overall decline over the period since 1980, we've actually seen the spread widen because interest rates have come down faster than allowed returns. The biggest reason for that is interest rates were going down and we didn't need many rate cases, so regulatory lag actually acted in the favor of public utilities. The average over that period was 489 basis points. That's the average spread. The spread last year was a little over 6.25. Very robust. Utilities have been performing very well in the last few years, and that's one of the reasons for it. However, I guess the question remains, what will the trajectory be as we get back into a cycle where rate cases are every year or every 2 years? That will minimize that benefit from regulatory lag and may actually trim the return available to my constituents. The next thing that happens when you go into a capital cycle and visit the regulators much more frequently is this. You end up with a series of pressures that result in what would typically be called regulatory lag. What this chart looks at is free cash flow before dividends, which is the bar chart measured on the left-hand scale, relative to the difference between allowed returns and earned returns on the right-hand scale. And what you see is that they're highly correlated. When utilities are visiting the regulator frequently and spending more than their D&A rate, they face regulatory lag due to depreciation, financing costs, the period during which rate cases take. And it's difficult to earn one's authorized rate of return. The right-hand side of this chart is forecast, but what we would expect is that we're right on the cusp of seeing utilities challenged to meet their authorized rates of return, as opposed to the experience of the last 20 years where we regularly outperformed those allowances. While this is going on, we're going to need to raise some money. 2005 was a year in which we actually shrunk the balance sheet as an industry. We bought back about $7.3 billion of debt and $7.2 billion of equity in total on the regulated space. Because of the capital requirements that that we've shown, we expect that we're going to move from that reality to needing about $20 billion a year of incremental debt, and between $3 and $7 billion a year of incremental equity. We haven't really seen a lot of that equity yet, even though the capital cycle has begun, mainly because utilities' balance sheets are in pretty good shape right now, and so we've been able to stretch them a little bit. And we've also been able to sell a number of non-core assets that the industry got involved in the late 90s. They're right now can be sold for pretty good cash proceeds. We think we're probably winding down that phase and we're going to get into more traditional financing. We're going to do this at a time that frankly is quite benign, but a little bit more challenging than we've seen recently. This is Lehman Brothers' forecast for the 10-year. It's slightly upward sloping. You know, the scale is pretty tight, though. We've been wrong for 5 years, so I don't know why we're going to be right this year, but it could go up. And if it does, it promises to give a little bit tighter environment than we've seen. Right now, the globe is just awash in liquidity. Money is easy. Spreads are tight. Equities are cheap in terms of cost. And that is something that I think that as an industry we need to be very careful about becoming complacent about, because it wasn't so long ago that it was very difficult to raise money during the California energy crisis, the Enron collapse. And it doesn't take a whole lot to get back there, and right now it's very easy. One of the things that on a policy front may provide a bit of a catalyst to change the cost of equity capital is tax policy with regards to common dividends. With the change in leadership in Congress in November, it appears that for the near term we're probably at a stalemate. Right now, dividend policy expires in 2010, and that would move us from a 15% max rate to ordinary income. It's quite likely that the leadership in Congress would like to see that happen more quickly, but the president is very unlikely to sign it. So it looks like the current policy will be the policy through 2008. And it's our view that the easiest way to deal with this tax issue, rather than actually reverse it, is to let it expire. This tax policy alone represents between 8 and 12% of the value of the equities in the group right now. And if the market believes the story that I just told, then we're going to start to discount back that value as we approach 2010. And the trigger point for that, as I just said, just passed with the change in Congress, which changed the complexion of tax policy. And then finally, a risk that falls back to management as we move into a capital cycle is the requirement to execute on what amounts to a vast infrastructure investment. And for the most part, the executives in our industry weren't there last time around. So some of this is brand new. We need to effectively manage cost estimates. That hasn't been going so well recently. Because of the increase in material costs and labor, we've actually seen a rise of between is 20 and 100% on cost estimates of various technologies. Scrubbers are up on average about 20% over the last 3 years. Estimates for new construction of a combined cycle is up as much as 40%, depending upon location. Nuclear estimates, since we started talking about nuclear reemerging, have roughly doubled from the first discussions till now for Greenfield. We've also started to see dates slip. We're seeing 6 to 12 months delays in in-service dates for a lot of the programs, mainly because of labor and lining up engineering construction contracting work. All of these things have to be managed effectively in order to maintain a low cost structure. So, those are the challenges on the capital cycle and the challenges that currently face the raising of capital for this infrastructure that we need, and what our challenge is between appropriate regulation, good management, and maybe a little level-headedness on the part of Wall Street is a challenge to avoid this chart. This chart from 2005 left is the history of the relationship between equity risk premium and free cash flow. Left-hand scale is the same one I showed before. It's free cash flow pre-dividend, so it tracks capital formation. The right-hand scale this time measures the risk premium in addition to the risk-free rate that was discounted over these years, and you see, again, a high degree of correlation. It's inverse this time. When utilities run a free cash flow deficit, the risks that I spoke about previously find a home in a lot of worry amongst investors, and we don't pay as much. And the cost of capital gets quite a bit higher. It's our challenge this time to put in place appropriate policies and mechanisms to try to moderate this, because if we repeat the 70s, we're going to be very challenged in getting the amount of new equipment on the ground necessary to provide a reliable service over the next 5 and 10 years. And then there's carbon. And there's just a terrific story to be told about the environmental improvements of the electric utility industry over the last decade. The performance that the industry and policymakers have shown on smog, acid rain, soot, and mercury have really been pretty marvelous. And I think we are very likely to head down the path of using some of the same methodologies, cap and trade, or maybe even a tax to try to attack the global challenge of carbon. There are some differences that create a potential for huge uncertainty depending upon how that policy is structured. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on a couple of slides here. They're really just for review, but this next slide is just a state of the world. In the United States, we currently regulate smog, acid rain, soot, and mercury, and we don't currently regulate greenhouse gas emissions. It's our view, both as a firm and my personal view in following what goes on in Washington, that we are very unlikely to get greenhouse gas legislation until the White House changes, but we will get it in the first year of a new presidency. Implementation date is likely to be 2013 to coincide with the end of Kyoto, and it's leaning towards cap and trade. I'm very concerned about that leaning for some reasons that I'll explain. I'd rather see a tax. This next slide is also a review of just, you know, what policymakers are currently considering, and what they're considering is what are the price trade-offs for regulation, what are the environmental trade-offs for regulation, what are the implications given our current fuel mix, and how do we get there legislatively in a way that you can pass new regulations in a bipartisan way. This slide and the next couple just take a look at why the momentum seems to be moving forward as well as it is from the standpoint of acceptance that we can overcome through technology and other means our challenges on carbon. And I think the real answer to that is that we were so successful with other pollutants. The cap and trade program for NOx and SOx have been enormously effective in clearing at a price that has encouraged the addition of pollution control equipment. These two graphs simply show the recent trend in NOx and SOx emission prices. Because we put a lot of that equipment in place, prices have been plummeting, which is basically to say that we're meeting our objectives. We're actually, in some cases, exceeding our objectives. What we've done to meet these objectives is put a whole lot of stuff on the back of a coal plant. And this is an outline of what that stuff is. It's scrubbers and catalytic converters and low NOx burners and bag houses. It amounts to roughly between a half and a doubling of the original cost of the plant. But it was done over a time frame that was reasonable, with regulatory support that was reasonable, and it resulted in this picture for our emissions profile, which is, it's actually gotten better than this as my series only ends in 2004. And so it's natural to think that we can do the same thing to this one. This is carbon. But here's the rub. There is no commercially proven technology to put on the back end of a coal plant to capture and sequester carbon effectively. And so what's different this time is we're hoping that science catches up to policy. Cap and trade scares me because it sets an objective for emissions and lets the market clear price. If you don't have a technology solution, so you don't know what the cap price is, you open yourself up to a great deal of volatility around what it might actually ultimately cost. I prefer a tax because you can dedicate tax proceeds to development, to R&D, but no one's going to ask me, and it's probably going cap and trade. It also impacts an unfortunately large amount of our current generation. 52% of U.S. production is coal-fired and dirty, and baseload. With an inelastic demand curve, or excuse me, inelastic demand curve exactly, what you end up with is a pretty big cost impact on the baseload end of the curve. Without much conservation, you won't see a lot of conservation response to these initiatives. You're more likely to see a price response. And so this is the last slide I'll leave with. And this is just a survey of the current view, a range of views around what that cost might be. If your objective is to set a cap on carbon where you cease additional carbon emissions in the U.S. at some date circa 2050, the cost estimates range from those behind the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast, which have proposed maybe $1.50 a ton of tax, to my estimate for an initial tax, which would be $12.50 a ton. To the Europe experience with a midpoint around $20 a ton with a range of 15 to 30. To bench science on the low end of sequestration technology for an IGCC plant at $35 a ton. To our chief strategist, Dr. Llewellyn's estimate of the economic trade-off to actually reach an equilibrium with no carbon growth in 2050 of $80 a ton. If you want to turn this into an electricity price, divide by two, and that's per megawatt hour. These are huge numbers. And so this is the, you know, this is the next one that probably keeps the capital needs in this group going well beyond the end of this decade. So a lot of challenges. It is a wonderful time to be a policymaker because we can be part of this. It's a wonderful time to be a stock picker because it's going to be volatile. I'm looking forward to answering questions. Thank you.
Why don't we go ahead? All is fresh because we're doing okay on time.
Sure.
If there are questions, let's go ahead and take a few now on this. I think these microphones are set up, or if not, I guess I have a question. It seems, I know here in Florida, one of the issues we face in terms of infrastructure costs, at least what we face with the commission, well, for example, to put this in context, last year our legislature passed a bill that was intended to incentivize nuclear construction with the whole concern about diversification, et cetera. And we just recently went through rulemaking. It seemed one of the things that was driving that whole project was the desire and need in a heavily capitalized project that takes a long period of time to build to make sure that there's cost recovery early on. And that seems to be a general trend in terms of a lot of the types of matters that are coming before us. So I was curious as to how Wall Street is looking at those types of issues. It almost seems like there's, if you will, a cycle in which the pressure to recover early is important.
Yeah, and this actually goes to the investor question of what do you own and what do you not own. And one of the things we do, and I didn't include the slide here, but it's available to all of you if you'd like it, is every year we rate the individual state utility commissions, and we rank them using five criteria. Spread to cost of funds, whether the commission is appointed or elected, so how close to the consumer is the politics. We look at incentive-based rate making, which in its broader sense includes all of these things like cash quip, you jumped over the need for use and useful. You're unique, you and Georgia, that's it. We also look at the absolute price level in the state, which seems to have a big impact on what people will stomach. Northeast, for instance, is very resistant to price increases because they're already paying quite a lot. And then finally, we look at the tendency to litigate versus settle cases, which is both a sign of cooperation and also a way to minimize regulatory lag. Florida has consistently ranked in the top decile from a shareholder standpoint. And while that, you know, sometimes the reason I didn't present the slides, I know there's a lot of regulators in the room, and sometimes when I've presented that in the past, the regulators bristle and say, I don't want to be in the top decile. But in truth, you do, because if you go the next step and do a study of what the top decile actually yields in terms of both reliability, customer satisfaction, and price, the top decile state regulators are the best in those three categories. Because if you provide an environment where appropriate capital investment can be made at a reasonable cost of capital, that turns into adequate supply, so good reliability, good customer satisfaction, and the ability to attract cheap capital. We love Florida as a place to own, and as we go over this cycle, frankly, we want to be long the Southeast and short the Northeast for the stocks, and that's how it'll play out in my view.
I didn't know about that slide, so that wasn't a setup. But
no, it wasn't a setup, but
any questions in the audience? All right, thank you, Dan.
Thank you.